This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good afternoon. I'm Claire Brindis, and I'm the director of the Philip R. Lee Institute for Health Policy Studies. And on behalf of our steering committee, I'm really delighted to welcome you to the 11th Health Policy Chancellor's Lecture at UCSF. I want to give a shout out to Steve Schroeder, who was really the instigator for this idea. And you can see the list of luminaries who have attended and have come to our campus. And we're really delighted that George Halverson has joined us this afternoon. This is really an important platform to bring our community of UCSF to recognize the importance and the compelling nature of health policy issues that surround us, whether you're a clinician, a researcher, an individual citizen, because many of these topics really are impacting all of our systems. And I really also want to thank Mark Larratt, who was so instrumental in approaching George to come today, and you'll be hearing a really very interesting an exciting lecture. Before I introduce to you our chancellor, who all of you know, Susan Desmond-Hellman, this is her last lecture, and so for a moment I just want to say a particular thank you. You've been incredibly supportive of health policy, both before your UCSF days when you were involved so strongly in the development of drugs, new drugs that would impact so many millions and millions of patients, not just in the U.S., but across the world, and making it accessible to individuals through a variety of mechanisms through Genentech. And then through your time here at UCSF, you have really been very supportive of the Institute, but also recognize the importance of thinking about our basic science of discovery, our clinical arm, and as well as our policy wins, and how all of those themes really are the DNA of this institution. So I just really want to thank you for your kind support and welcome you to do the introductions.
Thank you very much, Claire. So I am really happy to be here as we continue to bring outstanding health policy leaders to UCSF who can provide us different perspectives on health policy issues and highlight the important role that health policy plays in the lives of our faculty, our trainees, and our students. And as you just heard, this is the last time I get to introduce our speaker for this speaker series. And so I did want to take a moment to reflect on how much we're at a crossroads in healthcare. Because of the Affordable Health Care Act, millions more people will have access to healthcare, but it's still too expensive. And now we're faced with the problem of how to do more with less. The next chapter of my life will be leading the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and I share the foundation's belief that every person deserves the chance to live a healthy and productive life. I'm excited to continue to contribute as a leader in that effort, but I'm, as you can imagine, sad about leaving UCSF. So I want to tell you it's the work that we do here and the work of health policy leaders such as our speaker today that are going to bring forward these solutions in health. So I'm really happy to join a long list of UCSF folks who play leadership roles, many of whom are in this room. So I'm telling everyone, you haven't seen the last of me, and I'm only going up to Seattle. For the very few in this room who don't already know George Halverson, he served as chairman and chief executive officer of Kaiser Permanente from 2002 to 2013, and he's been a key influential figure in the healthcare industry. George is widely credited with leading the successful rollout of Kaiser Permanente's multi-billion dollar information technology initiative, Kaiser Permanente Health Connect. During the debate over the Federal Affordable Care Act, many government officials cited Kaiser's integrated approach to patient care as a model for improving quality and reducing costs. Prior to joining Kaiser Permanente, George was president and chief executive officer of Health Partners, headquartered in Minneapolis, for nearly 18 years. With more than 30 years of healthcare management experience, he's also held several senior management positions with Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota and Health Accord International. George chaired the International Federation of Health Plans and co-chaired the Institute for Healthcare Improvement Annual National Forum on Quality Improvement in Healthcare for 2010. In 2009, he chaired the World Economic Forum's Health Governors Meetings in Davos. He is now chairman and CEO of the Institute for Intergroup Understanding and was appointed by Governor Brown to chair California's first five California Children and Families Commission. The Institute works on issues of ethnic and racial conflict. The commission works on creating optimal health and learning opportunities for the children of California under the age of five. Today, George will be sharing his experience from his many years leading Kaiser, as well as steps for creating a paradigm of continuous improvement and patient focus. He asks how technology can change how we think about healthcare, something we here at UCSF continue to debate and explore. He's also one of the smartest people I've been around and makes things happen. So please join me in welcoming George Halverson. Welcome.
Thank you so much for the introduction and for the opportunity to be here. And congratulations on your own wonderful new trajectory. That's going to be a lot of fun. Good to do. I'm going to talk a little bit about the culture changes that can be done in an organization. Before I move to that topic, I'm going to move to something that is cited in one of the books that you see on the screen. The books you see around the title all deal with healthcare reform and various ways we can improve the delivery and financing of healthcare, and they're primarily focused on the delivery of care. The book that says "Don't Let Healthcare Bankrupt America" is the most recent book. It's intended to be my final healthcare book, and there is a chapter in that book that deals with Medicaid and deals with the children of America. And what that chapter talks about is the fact that when you look at what is the best predictor for who is likely to be in prison at age 18 in this country, the predictor is the number of words in a kid's vocabulary at kindergarten. Kindergarten. If you look at the kids in kindergarten who have vocabularies of 500 words and 1,000 words and compare them to the children who have vocabularies of 5,000 words and 10,000 words, the children with the small vocabularies do not learn to read. They end up 40% more likely to be pregnant while in school. They are 60% more likely to drop out of school, and the majority, overwhelming majority of dropouts come from that group. And they are nearly 80% more likely to go to jail. And when you look at the people in our jails in this country, we have more people in jail than any country in the Western world by far, three times as many people in jail as any of the Western countries. When you look at the people who are in our jail, 70% of those people can't read. They either read poorly or they can't read at all. So we have a criminal population full of people who can't read. And so when they leave jail, they can't go out and get a job because they can't even fill in the job application. And when you look at their past, if you look at the trajectory that got them there, you can predict with 80% accuracy at age 3 whether or not they're going to be able to read and whether or not they're on that path. So it's the first 3 years of life. The first 3 years of life are where, if the brain gets exercised, the brain grows. Neuron connections happen by the millions. The brain becomes a very robust and healthy thing. And if the kids do not have their brain stimulated in those first 3 years, then that whole stimulation process shuts down. The brains are smaller. They're less effective. Those kids can't read, and they end up with worse health. They end up getting pregnant. They end up actually, the kids who drop out of school actually end up with a life expectancy 10 years shorter. It's about 9 years shorter than the people who end up going through and finishing their education. And so there's massive differences, and it's the first 3 years of life that make the difference. So we really, really need to focus on that agenda. And one of the things I'm suggesting in the book is that Medicaid for this country needs to take that on and incorporate into the Medicaid agenda the teaching and the education and the training, because another thing that's true is the vast majority of the mothers who are taking care of those kids who aren't, all of them love their kids dearly. They all want their children to succeed. But the vast, vast majority do not know that there's anything they can do to make their brains, kids' brains, stronger in those first 3 years. And if they don't know that, then they can't do the things that are needed to make it happen. So the part of our society and the part of our culture that is reading to the kids and talking to the kids and playing with the kids and having the kids with their own iPads by their age of two, I mean, you've all seen that part of the world, those children are ending up with being the smartest kids we've ever had and having the best scores on the ACT, SAT types of testing that we've had in the history of the country. And the other end of the continuum, we've got an increasing number of kids who can't read at all. So we're becoming bipolar, not just in our finances, we're becoming bipolar in our mental capabilities, and we need to change that. We've got to fix that, and we have to deal with that issue. And so that's something that I'm going to be personally working on and committed to through the first five and through some other things I'm going to be doing, because we need to have people understand that. And I'll move off this topic with a comment that when mothers and fathers and families understand that, what we're seeing, we're doing some focus groups and we're doing some research, we're identifying that when they understand that opportunity, they all love their children, and people say, wow, I did not know that I could strengthen my child's brain. And that causes a different, it's a new paradigm. It causes a new thought process, and with the new thought process, life trajectories will change. And every child you save, talk to anyone you've got to know who's having a child right now. Share this information with them, because every life that you change is a life that you change for good. It's a permanent change. So make that change. I'll start with that as a topic and then come back to it. But let me talk for a little bit about cultures. Cultures are fascinating. Every organization that we have creates a culture. We are instinctively wired to create a culture. We create a culture that tells what we should do and should not do in any given setting. If you get a bunch of people standing in line, they will create a culture for the line. And the line, that culture will have the rules of whether or not you can cut in, whether or not you can take a bathroom break, whether or not, I mean, and then we not only are so wired to create a culture, we actually enforce the culture in the context of the line, and we get angry. Road rage happens when people go outside a cultural expectation. We are just wired to create cultures in every setting. Anytime a group of people get together, they create a culture for that setting. Organizations do that, nations do that, communities do that. So we end up with cultures, and what cultures have embedded in them is rule sets. These are the things we should do in a culture, and these are the things we should not do in a culture. And one of the key things that a culture does is explains to people why they should do a particular thing. If an organization's culture is based on pure autocracy, then the why is because that's what the boss wants us to do. But that's the why. If it's a democratic culture, it's a different setting. Culture you have, rules are built, and then people make decisions based on those rules and get guidance from those rules. Now, one of the things that's fascinating about our lives is that we are heavily influenced by instinctive behaviors. We have instincts to be maternal. We have instincts to be paternal. We have instincts to be hierarchical. We have instincts to court. We have instincts to have turf. Turf instincts drive behaviors all over the planet. Hierarchical instincts. Every organization you go to has a hierarchy. There's always somebody, there's a chain of command, there's somebody who's in charge of any group of people gets together, they will form a hierarchy. And the instinct is to have the hierarchy, and we feel secure when our instinctive needs are met. So instinctive behaviors that are aligned with our instincts feel right to us at a very basic level. So we feel right to defend our child. We will do outrageous things to defend our child because we have those instincts are activated and they cause us to feel that. So the instincts cause us to act in particular ways. What our cultures do is our cultures give us the toolkit and the template to actually achieve the instinct. So if you're in any setting, you know that the setting is going to have a culture. You know that the culture is going to drive behavior. And if you're trying to lead an organization, you know that if you can have the culture of the organization go the direction you want it to go, and if you can have a clearly defined strategy for where you want the organization to go, and if you communicate the strategy clearly to all of the people, and in the context of that, if the culture is aligned with where you want things to go, then you end up getting decisions that are made on the front line over and over again that are in line with the direction you want to go. The combination of culture and strategy is very, very powerful. And a lot of people say culture trumps strategy, and I think that's true. If you try to do something strategic that is against the culture of your organization, people will sabotage it, ignore it, consider it an anomaly. But if you try to move in a direction that is aligned with your culture, and that's your strategic direction, then that creates a synergy and an energy that makes it more likely for you to succeed doing whatever it is you're trying to succeed organizationally. So if you're leading an organization, one of the things you want to do is you want to figure out what should the culture of this organization be. And that's something you should do very consciously, very deliberately. You should figure out what are the elements that we really want in this culture. And as part of the process of doing that, you need to say, what are the elements now? Where are we now? How do we feel about key topics now? How do we feel about honesty? How do we feel about candor? How do we feel about profitability? Whatever the elements are, how do we feel about that now? What's our current culture? And then what do we want the end game culture to be? And then you need to plot a path from the current culture to the end game culture that gets you to where you want to be in steps that are possible to achieve within your organization. So at Kaiser Permanente, a decade ago, we basically said, here's the end game culture we want. Here's the current culture we have. In some cases, the current culture is aligned with the end game. In some cases, it's not. And here's what we need to do to go from here to there in incremental steps. And if you want to get to a culture of continuous improvement, you have to go through a step in the middle where you have a culture where you are using data. And to get to using data, you have to go through a culture where you have trust. And so you can't just go to continuous improvement from a stopping point. You have to work your way through. So you have to do, when you're looking at a culture of an organization, is figure out what are the steps, where do we want to go, and then what process do we need to go to get there, and how do we bring people along in a way that people will believe in and support this and feel that this is the right model. And I'll talk about that in a second. So what we need to do is in organization, figure out where you are now and work from there. Now, when you figure out where you are now, one of the things that you'll discover is your culture has a whole bunch of elements in it that may not, but often does, that are not optimal for where you want to go. There are some cultural elements that need to be changed. Now, if you want to change a cultural element, it's like changing the core belief in a paradigm. Now, the core belief in a paradigm drives the paradigm. The world is flat. The world is round. Whatever the core belief is drives the paradigm. There are core beliefs in the culture. If the core belief in the culture is working in a perverse direction for where you want it to go, you can't just ignore that, and you can't just put out new pieces of data that contradict it, because new pieces of data that contradict a belief are considered to be anomalies and ignored. People have a remarkable ability to ignore contradictory data if their core belief goes in a different direction. And so what you have to do to change a core belief is you actually have to identify the core belief, delineate the core belief, explain the core belief, understand it, respect it, understand why do we believe this here? There's a reason we believe this. There had to be something that made that the core belief at some point in history. So go back and figure out what made that the core belief. respect it, and then very, very clearly say to people in that setting, you know, we've believed for many years that professors should be secretive. And that made sense because there was a time when people would have hurt professors if they weren't secretive or something. But today, we need professors to be transparent, and so we need to change from secretive to transparent. And if you go through that process of identifying what the old culture was and why it was, and then take people to the new place, they will follow to the new place and will shake off the old belief. But if you don't go through that process, what happens is people will cling to the old culture, will be secretive forever, and won't make any difference what you're saying about transparency. If people know in their hearts that secret is what wins, they're going to stay secret. And so changing a culture, you have to go through a process of identifying what you want to change, and then you have to respectfully change it in a way that communicates clearly to the people involved that this is the old change and the new change. So it's a very basic process. And a lot of organizations try to change cultures simply by sending out memos or having good intentions. And good intentions and memos are not sufficient generally to change a culture. But if you sit down and say, what do we want to believe in? How do we want this to be part of what we are? How will this drive our decision making? And then how do we get there? And then go through that in a very clear way. So that's, with that as a thought process, I'm going to go to the next slide, which says some of the steps that you really need to go through if you're going to change a culture. So these are very useful in healthcare, but they're useful in any other organizational setting that you happen to find yourself in. So the first place in culture change is delineation. You need to understand what it is you want to end up with. Just simply good intentions about changing culture is not sufficient. You need to figure out what are the end beliefs that we want to have collectively in the end. And you need to really get clear about that, because the clearer you are in your own head, and I'm assuming that I'm talking to a room of leaders who are going to go out and lead organizations toward cultural change. That's sort of the context that I'm doing this conversation from. So if it sounds like I'm suggesting you should go forward and do something that feels alien to you, just make the assumption temporarily that you're in a position where you are leading an organization and have an opportunity to do that. But the first thing you do is delineation and have a really clear sense of what you want the end game culture to be. And once you've gone through the delineation process, then you need to articulate that. You need to explain it. You need to be clear about it. You need to say it over and over again. One of the toughest things about being a CEO is you have to say the same thing over and over again to the point where you are so bored saying it that you put yourself to sleep saying it, and then you go out and tell it and say it again. But the most successful CEOs I've talked to in many settings have that as a trait, that they say the same thing over and over and over again. But you have to be able to articulate the culture, explain exactly what the culture is in a very clear way. And then you have to go through a codification process to the extent that you can define it in terms of this is a yes or a no. We will do it this way. We will not do it that way. It's kind of the rule set. It's the laws. And to the extent that cultures become laws, that's a pure codification process. You write the culture into the law. Women can now vote. That's a change in the culture, and that's a law, and you codify that, and the issue's over, and you have to codify. And then it's really, really important to explain why you're doing the new point. Whatever the new belief is, you have to explain it. The why is really important, because all of our paradigms are anchored in why. All of our paradigms answer why. And so why does the world look like that? Because it is round. So you have to answer the why question, and you have to explain it in a positive way. So explaining the culture is really important. And then you have to enforce it. You have to, once you've codified it, once you've explained it, once you've made it clear to people, once people understand the direction you're trying to go, once you've articulated it, then you need to enforce it, because an unenforced culture is ignored an unenforced culture has no impact. An unenforced culture actually creates cynicism. If you say we believe in this and that and the other thing, do something totally different. And when people do something totally different, you allow them to do something totally different. Then they go off and do whatever it is they're allowed to do. And that's the real culture. The real culture is what people are allowed to do. And so you have to enforce what you really want people to do. And if you enforce what you really want people to do, then they will do what you are enforcing. So enforcement is really important. And then reinforcement is really important. You have to keep reinforcing why. You have to keep reinforcing. You have to let this process go on, and you have to be reinforcing with people over and over and over again. And if you have clearly identified what it is you want the end game to be and what your values are going to be in the end, and then you go forward and reinforce it, then the likelihood of it sustaining goes way up. Celebration is really important. All cultures have celebrations. All cultures have things that they celebrate. They have coronations that they celebrate. They have successes they celebrate. And whatever it is you celebrate, people will believe is your culture. So if there's a particular behavior that somebody does that's totally in alignment with the culture, and you celebrate and say, look what Sarah did, look what Sarah did. You know, hooray for Sarah, and then you give her an award for doing whatever it was she did, and you make that part of the celebration, then that becomes a key component in the culture. In this culture, we are respected for bravery. In this culture, we are respected for problem solving, whatever. But whatever it is you celebrate, people live and understand things in the context of stories. So when you tell people stories, they take the stories and turn that into life learnings and life lessons. And so if you tell, and one of the beauties of a celebration is if you do it right, you get to tell the story. And in the telling of the story, you get to exemplify what it is you want things to be, and you get to stand back and you don't look like you're a person in the spotlight. You're like it's about you in the spotlight. You make it about the other person in the spotlight, and that gives you a lovely leverage point to tell your story, to tell your points, and to celebrate it. And the people who are celebrated love it. The people who are celebrated feel good about your culture, and they feel good about what they did, and they feel good about the process because they have been celebrated and acknowledged and recognized for doing it. So the celebration process is extremely reinforcing to people who, when you do that, right. And then it's really good to do to create icons. It's good to create exemplars. It's good. Inside Kaiser Permanente, we use Sidney Garfield all the time as an icon. Sidney Garfield was our original physician. He and Henry Kaiser invented the whole Kaiser Permanente model. And Dr. Garfield was a brilliant man, and he did all kinds of really lovely things. And one of the things he did before the Kaiser Permanente was a health plan, Henry Kaiser was building dams, and Sidney Garfield was taking care of the workers. And one of the things that Sidney did early in the process was he noticed that many, many people were coming in to his clinic with really bad lacerations. A lot of people were being cut. And Sidney said, okay, why are so many people coming in being cut? This is just abnormal. And he went out and discovered that nails that they were using to put plywood sheets up against the side of the dam were about 3 inches long, and you really only needed about a 1-inch nail to hold the plywood up. And so people weren't pounding it all the way in. They were leaving all kinds of nails standing out, and people were getting cut by those lacerations. So Sidney went to the people in the project and said, stop using 3-inch nails. Start using 1-inch nails. It's all you need. And he did it, and the cuts went away. Now, that's a story that we tell inside KP. And I just did a talk at the Institute of Medicine a while ago, and they had some KP people in the audience. And I said, how many people here know the Sidney Garfield story of the nails? And all the hands went up. Everybody knows that. Now, why is that an iconization? Because we thought outside the box, because it wasn't just take care of the cut when it came in the shop. It was think about how did that cut happen, and what can we do in the real world to go upstream and change that. And so that icon story for one of our heroes basically pointed to a way of thinking that is embedded in the culture, which is why at Kaiser Permanente, we have cut the stroke rate, death rate in half. We have the lowest HIV death rate in the country. We've cut our HIV death rate to half the national average, and we're doing that in communities that have high HIV populations. And we've done that by doing systematic, proactive, collaborative things for HIV patients, and we celebrate that. We celebrate those successes internally, but we tell those stories over and over again, and it's in the context of Sidney Garfield going upstream and cutting the nails down to a different size. So we, icons, personification is really important. Personification basically means if you're leading an organization and you are preaching something and teaching something, you should also be doing that thing. So if you're telling everybody, don't be a jerk, then you shouldn't be a jerk. If you're telling everybody, make decisions based on data, then you should make decisions based on data. Whatever it is you're preaching, you should be also doing. Because people, as a leader, people look at you to see what you're doing and get readings from what you're doing. And if you act out of accord with what you're saying, then again, the real culture is what you're doing, not what you're saying. And so it's really important. And once you become a leader of an organization, CEO, you are never off stage. You're on stage. Everything you do is on stage from that moment forward. And everything you do has some symbolism to it. And it's really important to, and it helps a lot if you actually believe in the culture. And if you believe in the culture and then you do the things that are in the culture, then that's really important for the extension of the culture. And then the final point on that list of 10 is basically you need to rejuvenate your culture. You need, things get stale. You can be going down a path successfully for a while, and important things are become routine, and people get bored, and they want to move on and do other things. And you need to go through a deliberate rejuvenation process that renews the energy and the culture. And if you do that, and if you do that long enough, then the cultures become self-sustaining, self-policing, and they take on a life of their own, and they become how we do things here, and people reinforce it with other co-workers, and the whole process becomes internally self-reinforcing. So if you think about cultures as a toolkit, and if you then go through a process that looks like this, to put the toolkit in place, then you're likely to have the culture succeed. So, Kaiser Permanente, a decade ago, we actually picked about 10 culture points, and we said, here's where we want to go. We want to end up with this set of beliefs that basically define our culture, and we want to be the people of Kaiser Permanente who do these things. So we had to figure out what, and then we had to move down a pathway to get to being the people who did those things. And we decided that we wanted to be a data-based culture. A lot of healthcare is not very data-based. It's science-based, but it's not data-based. And so we decided that we really wanted to be data-based. So we wanted to celebrate data, use data, create data. We wanted to have electronic medical records that had all the information about all the patients all the time, so we had access to data, and we wanted to think of ourselves as an organization that really has data, uses data, is good at data, celebrates data, feels good about data, and so we really wanted to make data something that we respected and honored and worked with, and along the way we had wins, and we had examples, and we had uses of data, and we did some research that was amazing. And when we had the research that was amazing, we celebrated that research with everybody and said, that happened here because we're Kaiser Permanente. We have data. We use data. We're smart at data. We did this well. And here's another example of how we saved lives and figured things out. And so the whole database culture was a deliberate part of the culture. And when we started, we were like the rest of healthcare. Most of healthcare is not very data-based. And we started with a different... We also said we want to be a culture of excellence, that we really want to get things right. The number one place on any list of quality success or outcome success, the number one place for Kaiser Permanente is number one. And so we're going to stop celebrating being in the half top quartile of things, and we're going to celebrate the things where we're the best. And if we're number one in the country at something, then we're really going to make a fuss out of that, and we will celebrate progress along the way. But we really need to be a culture of excellence. We need to have our internal expectation. By the way, borrowed some of these from the Mayo Clinic. I have to admit that Mayo has done some of this work, done it really well. You know, I love Mayo Clinic, and some of these are Mayo-based beliefs. But the culture of excellence, we decided we wanted to be a culture of excellence, and we didn't want people saying, hooray, we got to the upper half of this quality measure, look, over half the people in the country are worse than us. That is just not. And if you steer in that direction, if you steer toward being in the middle, you end up in the middle. And if you steer toward being at the top, you end up at the top. And so we basically said we can't. And then we picked some things and nailed them. We hit some things like sepsis, and we became the best health system in the country on sepsis death rate. And once you pick something important, use data to get there and become excellent, then you move forward. We said we wanted to be a culture of collaboration. We really want to celebrate collaboration, encourage collaboration, reward collaboration, that none of us are as smart individually as we all are smart together, that we really need to think together, work together, collaborate together, and that if we share with each other, teach each other, that we can be much smarter, better, and higher quality than if we do things alone. So we deliberately set up, and again, we celebrated collaboration. We set up, we got all of the, when we built the electronic medical record, we brought 70 of our medical leaders in from all over the country, and we had them spend a couple of months basically working on figuring out what we call the collaborative build. And the collaborative build was intended to figure out what's the best set of uses we can make of the system and what are the pieces that we ought to be putting in place. And we did that collaborative process in part so that we would have the collaboration. So when all those people got back in airplanes and when they flew back to Georgia or they flew back to Honolulu, they flew back with a set of insights, but they also flew back with a sense that they had been part of the process and that we had listened. And you have to do that in a very real and sincere way. If you bring people in and say you're going to listen to them, then you actually have to listen to them. And the process needs to reflect that. You have to have leaders who can do that. But we had leaders, Dr. Louise Liang was spectacular, and we had her do that, lead that collaborative build process. But so we said we want to be a culture of collaboration. Then we said we want to be a culture of continuous improvement. And this was absolutely foundational, because there's many different ways of looking at outcomes and results. And there's old management by objective, where you set a goal and you achieve the goal, and then you've done it, you've won. There's lean sorts of things where you try to lean down your process to do it more efficiently. Or this continuous improvement where you say, however well we're doing it now, we need to figure out how to do it better tomorrow. And to do it better tomorrow, we have to have the data in place to do better tomorrow. We have to have the toolkit. So when you make a commitment to continuous improvement as a model, then none of your results are ever your final results, and it's never satisfactory. You're always on a path of taking what you've learned up to now and moving it forward to the next stage of learning, and that's a really important. Some people are cultures of efficiency. Some places create. There's all kinds of other cultures you can create along that line. A continuous improvement was the one that we decided we wanted, and so we built it around continuous improvement. And then we set up a culture of service, and we wanted to be a service-based organization, providing service to our members, service to our patients, service to each other, and that servant leadership was the model we wanted to use, and we identified service as a key thing. Then we said we want to be a teaching culture. We want to learn things, but then we want to teach them. And we took, you know, we published 1,500 referee journal articles last year. From Kaiser Permanente. We want to learn things, and then we want to share that with the outside world. And when we did things like some of our data flow, our HIV, when we got our HIV protocols down, we went to Washington, held a press conference, and shared that. We had the Secretary Sebelius was there, and we shared those protocols with the world as a giving to the world, and that made it part of the culture, and that made people inside KP feel better about it. But when you become a teaching culture, that's different than being a secretive culture. It's different than being an internally focused culture that we know something that's a competitive advantage. We're just going to use that for us, and that's it. And that's a very different mindset, and you're less creative, I think, less innovative, less progressive if you do that. But if you become a teaching culture, that we want to learn this so we can teach the world. Culture of trust was really important, that we had to set up models of internal trust, and we made it just absolutely unacceptable for people to not tell the truth to each other, and that's a cultural importance. And then we put patient focus at the core. And I'm almost done with my talk, and I'll go to questions. But we put patient focus at the core. And we said we really need to be focused on the patient. We're not here for our own personal reasons. We're not here for stockholders. We're not here for profitability. We're not here for any of these other reasons. We're not here for pure medical science. We are here for the patient and the patient at the core. And we are one of the most heavily unionized healthcare organizations on the planet. And we negotiated into our union contracts, into our labor management partnership, this value compass that says patient member focus is at the core. And we said we're going to be the most affordable system, we're going to have the best quality, we're going to have the best service, and we're going to be the best place to work. And that's really important. We want to be the best place to practice medicine. We want to be the best place for a nurse to work. We want to be the best place for a clerk to work. And that we really value being a great place to work. We want people to feel good about coming to work in the morning because we are such a good place to work. We made that part of the value, but we also sat down, we have 100,000 people at Kaiser Permanente in unit-based teams. The unit-based teams are at the front level. Every part of the organization has unit-based teams, and the unit-based teams focus on the value compass. They pick some part of the value compass in each team and each site. Now, when people are on a team together, they work together, they like each other, they trust each other. Team behavior is totally different than non-team behavior. So when you get people to be, 100,000 people to be working on these small unit-based teams, you end up with absenteeism goes down, morale goes up, performance goes up, safety levels go, everything gets better in the unit-based teams, and we rate them by being highly successful, moderately successful, and the highly successful unit-based teams have the highest morale when we do employee surveys of anybody in the organization, because people love being on teams, they love performing at a high level, and the value compass is the anchor of that process. And so how is that done for us externally? We have number one ratings for Medicare. Medicare has a five-star program where they rate health plans all over the country based on five stars. They rated 550 health plans around the country. Only 11 health plans got five stars out of the 550 based on 55 measures of quality. And of the 11, eight were us. We swept it. Every Kaiser Permanente regional last year was five stars. And there were only a couple of other plans around the country that were five stars. One of them happens to be my old Minnesota plan, which I kind of feel good about as well. So Health Partners was in that five-star list. But the Medicare five stars wins happened because we had the tools, because we had the focus, because we made a commitment to be number one in every measure. If there was a measure, we decided to get there. J.D. Powers and Associates rated us number one among all health plans in the country. SAT Metrics rated us the number one brand in healthcare around the country. Consumer Reports rated in KP's regions, we won. All the major regions were the number one score by a significant level. So Consumer Reports said 2 years ago that the only brand that you can trust in American healthcare, the only major brand you can trust in American healthcare is Kaiser Permanente. You can go back and read that in there. Publication. 8 years before that, our Consumer Report numbers were really pretty less satisfactory. There was a lot of progress made, and it was made because frontline workers made that progress and did what needed to be done. And then there were 29 HEDIS scores, with the number one score in the country and the world was a Kaiser Permanente site. So that's the quality of care. So I'm going to end with One of the areas we focused on was hospital safety. So we looked at infection rates. We looked at bringing down the death rate from sepsis. Sepsis kills more people in hospitals than cancer or stroke or heart disease. Sepsis is the number one killer in American hospitals. We cut the death rate in sepsis down to under 10% from nearly 30%. So our sepsis death rates are quite low. But pressure ulcers was another area where we focused. And when you look at the national average for pressure ulcers, it's 5 to 10% of hospitals. Patients in hospitals end up with pressure ulcers. And when you look at our numbers, we decided that we were going to focus on that, and we took the numbers down, and we are now down to under 1% of our patients in our hospitals this last year had a pressure ulcer. That's a really low number. And what was really fascinating was several of our hospitals did not have one single pressure ulcer in a year. I did not think that was possible. I did not. In fact, when they brought me the numbers, I was actually, I have to admit, skeptical, because I didn't think zero was a possible number. But the reason zero was a possible number was because the nurses said, we're not going to have a pressure ulcer in our patients. It was a culture thing. It was a culture thing, not on my shift. No one, none of my patients is going to have a pressure ulcer. And we end up with a fanaticism about it. And when a pressure ulcer happened, those hospitals mourned. You know, most hospitals, you get a pressure ulcer, and people say, darn, another one. We better deal with that. And there's no darn, it's another one. I mean, it's literally a feeling of grief and regret and a cranking up. And so we've got hospitals that haven't had a single pressure ulcer. And so I'm going to end with the fact that this is why culture is important, because it took the continuous improvement culture to get down to zero, because we started at four, then we went to three, then we went to two, then we went to one. I mean, and we did that by sharing, learning, getting better, figuring out the pieces, figuring out the parts, sharing the parts and the pieces with each other, and getting there. So it took collaboration, took database decision making. We had to measure every piece of data over and over again. And then a commitment to excellence as a culture, and a commitment on the part of all those nurses. And this is the amazing thing, on a part of it, all the nurses at the front line to actually get to zero, because they basically said, we're going to do this right because we really care about our patients, and it's just not right that they get a pressure ulcer. So I'm going to end with that, be well, and go to questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much, George. I'd like to welcome you to, there are two mics on each side, and so please come and ask a particular question, and maybe I can ask you the first question while people are coming to the mics. So you've given us this very large view, the 30,000, 60,000, maybe even more view, but once you established your parameters of what the culture would be, how did you get that ship to shift to this new vision for Kaiser?
Well, each step was separate. We said we're going to be a database culture, so then we said, okay, if we're going to do that, then we have to have data. So then we said, okay, what does the data strategy look like? And then we said, we're going to have electronic medical record, we're going to have to do this, we're going to have to do that, we're going to have to set up these measures, we're going to have to do... So we put strategic pieces in place, because when you call people to do something, if you don't have the process ready at that point, then you call people to it and there's a frustration and a futility to it. So you have to actually put the pieces in place you're going to call people to. But then once you call people to it, then we got people to be database culture, and we started having wins with the data, sharing the data, using the data in meaningful ways. And every single caregiver wants to be a wonderful caregiver. Every single caregiver cares about patients. So the beauty of the world that we're in is that it's a world of people who care. And so you start with that, and you end up with people really wanting to end up in those places. But we had to have the tools in place to get there. And one of our adages, there's an old Zen saying that when the student is ready, teacher appears. Remember, people have heard that saying a lot. If you look back into the actual Zen culture, what that actually meant, it was not that when the student is ready, the universe will somehow mystically provide you with the teacher. And it's not even when the student is ready, you will start looking around for a teacher, although that's a better approximation. But what they actually meant in the old Zen master world was the Zen masters would identify a student that they wanted, and then they would wait for the student to be ready, and they would help the student get ready, and then they would appear. It was actually very proactive. It was not a passive strategy. When the student is ready, the teacher appears, is actually proactive. And we talk about that all the time with our leadership team. We need to hear this. That's why it answers your question. Because we said, we need to get the student ready, but then when the student is ready, that's the moment we need to appear. When the student is ready, we need to appear with the right stuff, and then when we appear with the right stuff, it'll become real and part of the process. So that's part of it. When the student is ready, the teacher appears.
And Sam, would you like to be the next?
Thank you, George. I want to thank you for the talk. You so calmly went through a series of what sounded like very simple steps, which I know is a complex issue to change. My question is, and it may seem a little semantic, but in exposition before explanation. And it seemed important that of the sequence. And in my experience, I've got myself into trouble just wondering why the order was not reversed.
That's a really, really, really good point, and it needs to be a reciprocal process. But the reason codification first is because you need to explain, you need to understand it exactly what it is you're going to explain. Because if you say we're generically leaning in this direction and kind of explain, then you can't get the right response to it. But if we say we think that effective immediately, no computer should not be unencrypted. Just pick one that actually was relevant at one time. That's the rule, and now provide the feedback to that. Then you get a different, or as opposed to saying we think explaining generically, we think that we ought to have more security on little computers, and then let people do it. So the reason for codification in advance was to so we really knew what we were explaining. But then what's really important is when somebody raises their hand and says that's stupid, that didn't work, or that's wrong, or that's out of, then you need to fix it. Yeah, because the whole process has to be responsive. You have to be respectful of all the people in the process. You have to learn from everybody. And when people have a better idea, you have to go there.
Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes. Dennis Hanson, PDF reporter. I have a question about, as an organization not part of an integrated healthcare organization, we have incentives to do more, to get paid more.
Yeah.
And one of the advantages of an organization like KB is we can change that culture. So this is part of our culture. How do we change that without being part of an integrated healthcare organization?
That's a really good question, and I think the accountable care organizations that are written into the Affordable Care Act are intending to create a template to do that so that the teams of caregivers can get paid a fixed amount in advance and then can come back and re-engineer care around that. And if you re-engineer care appropriately, you can do it in a way that doesn't reduce the amount of money that can go to the caregivers. The money goes to the caregivers for doing different things. So when we take care of our HIV patients, we still pay caregivers to do that, but we pay caregivers to do different pieces of that than they. In fact, we do 14 things in that process that do not show up on a Medicare fee schedule. If we only got paid Medicare prices for our HIV patients, our death rate would double. So we have to do that. But what you have to do is you have to, as an organization, move to a place where you've got an ACO kind of cash flow. You have to get the, you have to change the cash flow. And you're exactly right. If you don't change the cash flow, you're stuck with the world you're in.
Talmadge?
Yes, thank you very much for your presentation. So I have a couple of questions. One is about enforcement and how you did that, especially working with physicians. But during your tenure, Kaiser changed dramatically. And I congratulate you for that. But I wonder, as you look back now, and you're not far enough away, I think, to was it a sentinel event or one that actually allowed you to accomplish the thing that you accomplished or whatever that stands out as you look back?
We didn't have a sentinel event because we started this process 10, 11 years ago, and I actually had done a similar sort of process back in Minnesota at my health plan there. So we had put in electronic medical records. We got into database care and system-based care and process improvement and continuous improvement. All of those things were part of my belief system. When I talked to the Kaiser board about coming to Kaiser, I said, if you don't believe in these things, don't pick me to be your new CEO, and if you want to do these things, then I'm the right person for it. But that's the path we're going to go on. So there wasn't a KP sort of event that got me there. In terms of getting the organization ready to go down that path, there is a little triangle that I sometimes draw, and these are the triangle has on it the six things that will drive, that will bring people together and cause them to act in an aligned way. And the bottom thing in that pyramid is danger. If you can convince people there's an external danger, then people will align in a particular direction. The next line above that is common enemy. If you can convince people there's a common enemy, you can actually get people aligned, and it works. The next level above that is a sense of us, a sense of being a community, a sense of people will move together if you can create a common sense of us. The level above that actually is team behaviors. If you get people to function as a team and work as a team, they will overlook prior differences. And to be a team, you have to have team specifics, you have to have team energy, you have to have team assignments, you have to have team identity. There are certain things you have to have. But if you get people to function as a team, you can get all the oncologists together to be an oncology team. They will do spectacular work as a team. And team behaviors will trump some of the other behaviors. The line above that is collective gain, common gain or greed. You can bring people together. Everybody thinks they're going to do better financially with that. And then the highest level, the highest motivator, and the one that's hardest to use is mission vision. You can get people aligned around mission and vision, then they will work together. And we use them all. We talked about the dangers, the outside world, common enemy. I talked about Leonard Schaefer and Blue Cross and all the things that Blue Cross was doing to take our patients away under the common enemy, common danger sort of agenda, and people believed it because Leonard Schaefer was out there at that time trying to take our patients away, and he'd taken a few away. And that's very focusing. Once you start losing patients to an outside, we talked about having, we created the Thrive campaign, and we talked about being the people who believe in this campaign and created a sense that we were an us and not a bunch of internal fiefdoms and the sense of us. So we actually used all of those six alignment factors to get people aligned behind the culture, and then when people were aligned, they're more likely to move forward and do those kinds of things. And then also putting the electronic medical record in place was just really foundational, because we could have done all those other things, but if we wouldn't have had the tool to use in the end, then we just would have been incrementally better and not significantly better.
I think we'll have time for one more question. Please introduce yourself.
You mentioned ACLs, and I'm going to feel bad about bringing it up. The ACL movement is moving throughout the country, but it seems to be something lacking. The thing that's lacking is what you have, and that's an insurance payer. I don't think it's insurance anyway that payers pay.
Yep.
Insurance companies mess it up, and we should have our own insurance companies, which we did in the 1970s here in the HMO, in the physician-run HMO movement. By the way, our enemy then is Kaiser.
Yeah, that works really well. One of the things we brag about is the fact that when Kaiser is the common enemy, that care in the community gets cheaper. Hawaii, the lowest health care prices in the country, Seattle, Portland, really. I mean, any time KP is in the market, that actually forces everybody else in the market to be a little leaner. And so we're actually happy to provide that service as a as a function. But you're right, it's the payer function. It is a payer function, and the ACO model is only going to work if it becomes a meaningful payer function, and if it just becomes kind of a technicality alignment function, it will fail. You were exactly completely right.
So how do we do it?
But there are financial models that do that. There are pilots all over the country right now, and some of the pilots are being done really well. There are some good pilots out there, so I would learn from the best pilots and figure out how they're doing it.
Great.
Thank you.
So I want to say thank you very much to our speaker, and thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.